Just come out of the after party for the Broadcast Digital 2026 Awards, and you won't believe what has just happened. Time Team has just won Best Specialist Channel of the Year. Tony is still on the dance floor. I can't drag him off. It is so wonderful that we have won an award and we've had the acknowledgement that we are a brilliant channel, and that's all down to the Patriots. We're all absolutely delighted. Now I'm going to go back.
Coming up, geophysics from the Ness of Brodgar, which hints at a remarkable discovery.
How AI has finally unravelled scrolls from the ancient city of Herculaneum.
And Martin's meeting the archaeologists of the future on a site with its own fascinating story to tell.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams. And it's a busy old podcast this week. I have been to see our very own Meg Russell on a site in Dorset. You'll learn about some exciting discoveries at an extremely important place for English history. And later, Jackie McKinley's going to be here. She's packing, ready to go to Orkney, where the Time Team dig at the Ness of Brodgar is already underway. And right now, Time Team members on Patreon can watch our brand new film about the geophysics that we did at the Ness. And that ends with some remarkable geophysics images. It's very, very exciting stuff, Helen.
Yes. Now, John wouldn't tell us anything about what he had found, so I had no idea what I was going to see when I opened up the image. And what I, in fact, saw was a very geometrically perfect circle. There seemed to be about a dozen or maybe 15 stone settings or at least blobs that look like you could have put a stone in each one. Now, they don't seem to be evenly spaced, so there might be more that we haven't been able to see at this resolution, but there do seem to be kind of two main gaps. Now, either one of those could be an entrance, maybe. Remarkably, also, there's an anomaly right in the middle, right in the centre. What is that? Once you can drag your mind away from this very perfect circle, you can see some smaller alignments that look a bit like smaller circles and less perfect circles. As far as I can see, this is an extraordinary and perfect set, and something that we never knew about before. I mean, this is going to be years of work to try to work out exactly what every bit of this geophysics means.
Yeah, well, you can certainly tell why John was so keen to get Time Team to Orkney to dig that site. It could, by the way, be nothing. We just don't know, and that's the most exciting thing about it all.
I think all of us before have been tricked into particularly circular things. The trouble with an area that feeds cattle is that you get circular cattle feeders, and it doesn't take very long for the cattle around the circular cattle feeders to produce something that is very obvious in the landscape in an aerial photograph or on the ground. But this is geophysics. I mean, geophysics doesn't lie, does it, Martin?
Well,
and if John is excited, it's got to be something real.
Well, that's it. John is excited. A lot of people up at the Ness are excited. So, yeah, well, you just have to sort of watch this space. If you haven't seen the images yet, by the way, they're kind of all over Time Team's social media. They're on our Patreon as well for Time Team members. So do go and have a look, and we'd love to know what you think. We've got more on this, though, at the end of the podcast today, because Jackie McKinley's coming on. I'll also mention, if you are a Time Team member, you can watch that film. You can also find out what the team are getting up to in Orkney right now, because they are there. There's loads of Dig Watch updates, all that sort of thing, trying to take you to the very heart of the archaeological action.
First, though, to something that we actually discussed on this podcast months and months ago, and we were talking about how new technology can help archaeology. And I mentioned how at some point in the future, maybe AI will work to help us find some lost texts that we perhaps know about, but which are completely lost and we've never seen or read. Well, it seems the future is almost here.
Yeah, researchers have announced that they've achieved the first complete reading of a closed Herculaneum scroll burnt by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius nearly 2,000 years ago. And they've done it without damaging it.
Yes, and they've also announced that they're putting everything online to try to crowdsource more experts, not only classical literature specialists, but anyone and everyone, to try to speed up the work. Now, this, of course, is brilliant news. We love it when everybody comes together, not only the experts who know everything about something that there is to know, but people who have iconoclastic left-field ideas, which send us off in different and maybe very profitable directions.
So how is it done and what does it say? Well, Brent Seals is Professor of Computer Science at the University of Kentucky and led the project. I mean, congratulations, Brent. How did you do it?
Well, thank you, Martin and Helen. It's great to be here. We have been circling this moment for a while. The steps that we use to be able to get from a scan of the internal structure of this material to the place where we can actually read the text, those steps are all software-based. The rise of AI has accelerated our ability to do this.
And can I ask what the scroll actually says?
Well, we've read several now. One of them is a Philodemus work with the title and author extracted from the very center of the scroll, a real miracle, if you will, because the title and author are written at the very, very core of the scroll. And of course, we're not opening it, so we're reading it without opening it. But what we've discovered there is Philodemus wrote a book on gods, and it happens to be book 8. So there's a series of at least 8 books by Philodemus on gods.
Is this a known work or is this something totally new?
Well, in fact, we didn't know about 4 or 5 of them because
wow.
I think the series was only 1 or 2 books, not referred to anywhere else. Another amazing thing about this collection from Herculaneum is that everything is unique. There is no other witness to any of the works in this collection.
How much of a leap forward is this, Brent, in terms of technology? And what could it do in the future, do you think?
The technology is pretty amazing, really. And the crowdsource, I think, is going to be accelerated as well with AI. I really can't predict how the next step is going to go. I think it's just going to be crazy and great and wonderful.
And how many scrolls have you got at the moment from Herculaneum that you can use this on?
The original archaeological find at Herculaneum is recorded to have found around 1,800 scrolls. But of those 1,800 scrolls, the estimates are somewhere between 400 and 600 still unopened chunks of scrolls. Now, we've scanned 30 or 40 of those. We're 10% there in terms of scanning, which is the first step, of course. And then of that 10%, we've only read 3 or 4, so there you have it.
Wow. Can you explain a little bit more about the scanning process then? I mean, what are you using to scan these closed scrolls that enable you to see inside them?
Sure. One of the big steps forward early in this project, and by early I mean a couple of decades ago, was to realize that X-ray tomography, which is essentially 3-dimensional X-ray scanning, that kind of imaging would actually reveal both the internal structure of the scrolls themselves and also presumably the writing.
It just beggars belief, doesn't it, that there can be this amount of new work. And here you've got the possibility for 300 texts to change entirely the way we think about things, to give us an incredibly deep understanding. I mean, you must feel like you're standing on the edge of the most exciting discoveries ever.
I think with these digital methods and the last 400 scrolls, we have the chance to extract completely coherent texts, which is another real miracle for the scholars who are going to be given something that's much more linear and complete to be able to study. And that's a real gift.
This is so exciting, Brent, and we're going to wait with bated breath, I think, to see what keeps coming out over the next however many years. So it's brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much for making the time for us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Now, we've talked on the podcast before about periods of transition, haven't we? When one era moves into the next, how it's likely that cultures would have lived alongside each other for decades before blending together. And that's always really interested me.
Yes, and Bournemouth University are excavating a site where discoveries have spanned one of those transitions from the Iron Age into the Roman period. And students use the site for their field school to hone their archaeology skills, overseen by more experienced archaeologists like Time Team's Meg Russell, who invited Martin along for a look round.
Hey, Meg.
Hi, Martin.
Where on earth have you brought me?
We are at the Durotrigas project today. So we're in Dorset, and we've been digging here with Bournemouth University since 2009. And if you look across the field, you can see that we've been digging all of this area at different stages, like a jigsaw puzzle, to make up a map of what we think is happening in this area in the Iron Age. This year, we're looking, yes, at the Iron Age, but we're understanding that longer occupation into the Roman period, and finally starting to understand more of that land use, more of the people that were living here in the Roman period.
Well, it's absolutely beautiful here today in the middle of this field. I think it's, what is it, wheat, corn, something like that?
Yeah, it's a whole mix of different crops and it's different every year, which is quite nice.
There's a gentle breeze and you can just see it occasionally ripple through these crops. But right in the middle, this is the trench in front of us, and I can see a whole team of people all in their hi-vis working on individual pits that they're excavating. So what do you think you've got here?
We have an extension of some of the roundhouses that we've looked at last year. So that is our Iron Age settlement. But what we have new this year is we have some Roman structures, some rectilinear features.
Oh,
so
really
obviously different to our Iron Age spherical circular features. That is the Romans, and that's really, really distinctive. So we also see slightly different patterns of activity and then periods of end of use of features. So we can understand how things were left and how people left them. And we've also got some other interesting things that I really want to show you. So should we take a step in?
Yes, please.
Let's go. So over here, we have our trench supervisor, John, and he's just troweling a really interesting feature that I think he'd do very well to explain to us because it's a bit confusing.
John, hello.
Hello, Martin.
This is really interesting. Can you just describe what we've got here, what we're looking at?
Yeah, there's lots of shapes, isn't there? Things cut into the chalk, and it's, at a glance, quite incoherent. But actually, if you sort of stand and look around, you can see behind me there's a crescent. This small, thin gully is forming a half moon behind us. And in this depressed area in front of me, there's another gully. And these are actually roundhouses. We're thinking that they've got like wattle panels forming the walls that would have been daubed over, and then internal post structures forming the actual roundhouse shape.
This is Iron Age. Where does the Roman element of this site come in?
Well, we think this is actually very late Iron Age, and if not early Roman.
Oh, really? Okay.
So the Roman archaeology, the villa, and all the stuff that's obviously Roman, actually dates to about 300 AD. We're not really seeing the people before that. They were here, they were still living in here, but it's probably Durotrigian culture continuing, and they're still living in roundhouses, and eventually they become Romanized, or we're getting people moving in and building these Roman structures and walking around in togas and eating olives and being proper Romans.
Meg, there's so much going on this site. And I mentioned that there's lots of people in hi-vis. These are all the students, because this is not just a dig by a university. It's a dig by a university that aims to train the next generation of archaeologists.
Yes, we have students with us every year. And what's really nice is this dig just gives you so many opportunities to become the most well-rounded archaeologist. And the evidence is here because people keep coming back.
Hi, I'm Kira. I'm a student just going into my third year at Reading University, but I've been digging at the Durotrigas Big Dig since I was about 16. So at the moment, I'm working on a section of a ditch. So there's a lot of really badly fired pottery, a lot of kiln furniture, and also there's just a lot of pottery shards in general. So I think this was kind of just an area for them to deposit a lot of kind of pottery that just went wrong. It's really great being up here, actually, because obviously there's only so much you can learn in the classroom. You need a lot of practical skills, you know, even if that is just troweling or kind of recording your own feature is just so important, especially if you want to go into a job in archaeology as well.
And what is it about archaeology that you love that made you want to do this in the first place?
Well, I live on Cranbourne Chase and there's so much archaeology, so many barrows, that I've just always really been interested in it. So when I heard about this dig that was so close to home, I thought, you know, just give it a go. And they haven't really been able to get rid of me since.
Oh, wow. Edie, that looks beautiful.
Thank you.
What have you got, the edge of the pit there?
We have.
Hello, my name's Edie. I'm a second year student and I'm digging a very mystery feature at the moment. We've got a few pits, they're all sort of cutting into each other, and then we've got a very interesting ditch to the south. So we've got lots of different features going on and we're trying to understand how they correlate to each other.
Not only then are you learning about archaeology here, mm-hmm. you're also doing something else which is really important now in 2026, which is the social media.
Yes, it's been so amazing. We've had so much lovely support. We've been doing trends, we've been doing day in the life, even just answering people's questions, because I think it's really important in archaeology. It's something that people are so interested in, but not everyone has the accessibility to be able to do it. So it's really nice that we can put it on social media and they can engage with it and they can learn from their own homes, but it also inspires people to come to site and then do it themselves.
Well, I'm going to leave you to the actual archaeology work now, as well as the social media work, and I'm going to find where Meg's got to.
Lovely, thank you.
I'm just moving these planks because what we don't want to do is damage our skeletons. So under
skeleton!
I know, very exciting. Under these planks and under that tarp as well is a skeleton that we believe is a Roman individual. We think that they are definitely Roman because they have hobnails with them. So we know that they were wearing their boots, which we know Romans did. That's a typical feature that we would find with our Roman graves. And they're also typically Roman because they're extended. They're almost replicating that shape of the ditch and very different to our late Iron Age and middle Iron Age burials.
John's here as well. How surprised have you been to find a skeleton here on this dig?
This is new for the site. We've not seen them in ditches before. We're wondering if maybe these are people at the lower end of the social class spectrum, perhaps slaves or farm workers. Meg said this one has its shoes on. The other one had absolutely nothing with it at all. That was a male, and it looks like this person's had a very hard life, lots of pathology on the bone. That's really obvious, so I expect once we look at them really closely, we'll see all sorts of interesting things, but definitely someone who's had a hard-working life.
Can I have a little peek?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to get down low.
Okay.
And under this plastic, stopping it from drying out in the sun, you'll see that the skull.
Oh, wow.
Perhaps a slightly shorter person.
I was going to say, not particularly long here, so we're not looking at a very tall person.
They're definitely shorter anyway, but until we can see how it's arranged, the knees might be bent, it might be slightly crouched, so yeah, but it's definitely the full thing. And next week when we clean the skeleton and expose it fully, it's going to look really impressive.
Great. Wow, well, I didn't think I'd get to see a skeleton on a trip here. Meg, thank you so much for showing me around.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're a welcome anytime.
That is such an interesting sight, isn't it, Martin? I mean, the not just the change between the Iron Age and the Roman period, but also the fact that there are human remains. It means that you can come face to face with the people who are living through those transitions. And one of the things that I've always found interesting is the way that there's a slight disjuncture between the house styles or the kind of domestic life in a village and personal objects that belong to an individual. Roundhouses are so characteristically Iron Age, but they do crop up in the Roman period. And that's particularly been driven home to us recently because we've been digging with Operation Nightingale at Charrington in Gloucestershire, where there was a huge, a beautiful and perfect roundhouse, apparently Iron Age, but every single bit of dating evidence showed that it was actually Roman. And that dating evidence was objects. Personal objects like brooches are quite common to change to Roman styles really quickly. And pottery also changes really fast. Anything that you can buy changes quickly, but the things that you have to build or that you do every day, like agriculture and houses and settlement styles, they can persist for a really long time. So it's not a simple thing. And to be able to have the human remains can show us other things, like how quickly were food styles, cuisine, how quickly was that changing? Was that one of the long-term things that changes only very slowly, or was it one of the quick things? And teasing out all these different parts of life is so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, I would have loved to have been there at the time and just sort of living amongst people who were going through this period of change. They were in the Roman period. There would have been people who were Roman kind of going around, and they're embracing some of that culture, but also keeping to the culture that they would have known for, you know, passed down for centuries before. I just find the whole thing so interesting. And those periods of change, those transition periods, which in some cases lasted decades and decades, really, really interest me, because we just don't think about it that way. We think that on one day people were living in the Iron Age and on the next day they were living in the Roman period, and they completely changed everything about the way of life and everything that they did in a split second, which is obviously not the case. I just think it is so interesting. I should mention, by the way, on Patreon right now, you can actually see the site for yourself. I take you on a little tour. You'll meet some of the archaeologists, you meet some of the students, and you learn more about that transition period I was talking about between the Iron Age and the Roman era. If you head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial, you can get that and loads more.
Now, the Wars of the Roses were bloody battles fought for control of the English throne between 1455 and the 1480s. They were a struggle between the descendants of different sons of Edward III and ended in the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485 with the start of the Tudor dynasty. And that's because after winning his decisive victory, Henry VII, who was a Lancastrian, so the Red Rose side, he married Elizabeth of York, who was on the White Rose side. And one battle of the Wars of the Roses in particular has been making headlines recently because of some new discoveries that have been made there.
On the 29th of March in 1461, the forces of Henry VI of the House of Lancaster and Edward IV of the House of York, this is some 100,000 men in total, met at Towton Hall near Tadcaster for the Battle of Towton.
Now, I was living in York in 1996 when a mass grave was found in the village of Towton, and I well remember the shock at us coming face to face with the realities of a medieval battle. And archaeologists have discovered human remains more recently, partially buried under the foundations of Towton Hall, which is just outside the village.
So let's speak to Tim Sutherland, who's the director of the Towton Battlefield Archaeology Project. And Tim, how surprised were you then to make this discovery under the foundations of the hall?
We weren't really surprised on this occasion, because the reason we were there was because the landowner had to take a huge tree down that was growing next to the hall. But this tree was growing, one, right next to where we'd found the mass grave in 1996, but also where we'd found subsequent burials, individual burials. So he chopped the tree down, and before he pulled the roots up, I said, can we do an excavation around the tree? Because I think we're going to find a skeleton or two. So that's what happened. We started to dig around the roots and then chopping each root off with a chainsaw until we got down to some soil levels, and then there was some unmistakable outlines of what looked like graves. We excavated them, and surely enough, there were some more human skeletons.
I mean, I'm trying to get my head around the way that you dispose of bodies after a battle. You're not going to put them all in lovely, neat little graves, especially if you're the victors. How did they clear up a battlefield that's had tens of thousands of combatants?
Well, Towton's unique in that it's absolutely full of human remains and also other archaeological evidence of battle. Now, Towton lies about 1 mile from what most people consider the centre of the battlefield. And we did some work there in 2003, and we found where the mass graves were, the big mass graves from the centre of the battle. Well, Towton Hall lies about a mile away. And in 1996, we found another mass grave when they were building the extension to the hall. And that was a minimum number of 38 individuals. I think there's probably between 45 and 50 in there because the builders had already removed part of the grave. So we don't know how many were in the initial part. And that mass grave we thought was isolated and it was just a one-off. And then a few years later, we found an individual burial slightly further up the garden. And this individual was half buried underneath Taunton Hall. And that was a few metres away from the mass grave. When we excavated the mass grave in 1996, we had to leave a garage foundation in. And it was a big wide piece of concrete, about a metre wide. And so in 2003, we went back and we thought, well, we know there are human remains under that concrete. So we'll lift that concrete up. And then we found some more, not only the bones from the mass grave, but we found another individual skeleton half buried underneath Taunton Hall. So that meant we had a mass grave and two individual skeletons. And then the space in between is where the tree was. So now we've taken the tree down and we found two more skeletons. All the individual skeletons were individually buried. Well, we thought we were. Even that's not clear. Because inside the dining room, where the wall bisects these skeletons and cuts them in half, inside that room that's inside the building, we also found four more skeletons. So now we've got a mass grave with 38 minimum number. We've got four individuals outside. We've got an individual inside and we've got a triple grave inside. And all these individuals, as we can call them that, graves, have been treated in the proper Christian manner. So head to the west, feet to the east, and they'll be given a certain amount of respect shown to them at the point of burial. Now, the mass grave, they started burying them in a respectful manner, but as we got further down the grave, it had all gone completely haywire, and they were west-east, east-west, and some were prone, some were supine, so some were face-up, face-down, and then we got to the very end of the grave, and there was an individual that had been put in at a right angle. Basically, we could see that these individuals had been placed into the small hole. So they'd run out of space and they'd have to put these individuals in.
It's almost as if you can see the way that people were thinking and the way that they were tiring out and running out of time and space. It must have been such a massive undertaking.
Huge. But also, as you said, you can see the human nature takes over. They'd started off, or they appear to have started off, doing the right thing. And then eventually, at the end of the mass grave, they'd just given up. They'd lost their method. Some individuals had been treated with the utmost respect, and some with no respect whatsoever. They were face down in a mass grave, usually facing the wrong direction. It's fascinating, really.
Tell us a bit more about the actual battle, because I have read estimates that say something like, it might have included as many as 1% of all the young men, the men of fighting age in England at the time. Is that typical of a Battle of the Wars of the Roses? And what was the outcome of the battle? Was it pivotal? Did it change history?
Well, it did for the Yorkists, because before Taunton, the throne was still up for grabs. And so it was Taunton that put Edward on the throne. So did it have an effect? Yes, it did. Without Taunton, there would have been no victory for Edward. Without Edward being on the throne, there would have been no Yorkist dynasty. And without a Yorkist dynasty, we would not have had Richard III. In that respect, Taunton was pivotal, but it didn't really stop anything. It put everything on hold. But regarding numbers, as your earlier comment, it is almost certainly the case that it's been highly inflated. One of the reasons you would highly inflate it, because this was the New Yorkist dynasty. And of course, they wanted to put their stamp of authority on it. And so they inflated everything, and everything got out of hand. The heralds, who were supposed to be the people who told you what is and what isn't at the time, said there were 28,000 people killed. It's completely implausible because the numbers are massive. And now I would suggest there's probably 2,000 to 3,000 killed at the very most, and that would be huge for a medieval battle anyway.
I think we're going to have you back again because there are so many other questions to ask about the condition of the skeletons, about the injuries, about what you could potentially get out of them if you had all the time and the money in the world, what you've already got out of them and so on and so forth. We've absolutely just scratched the surface here. I think, Martin, don't you, that we'll have to have Tim back to give us some more detail?
Without a doubt. I'd love to get you back on, Tim, and hear more about it.
Gosh, we could do a whole hour on this, couldn't we?
Maybe we will.
Or 30 years, in fact.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for coming and talking to us about it. It's just been fascinating and I'm so keen to hear more.
It's all right. You're welcome.
Now, in November last year, we brought you some really exciting news, didn't we? Time Team would be heading to Orkney, a collection of islands to the north of the Scottish mainland, home to the Ness of Brodgar, a remarkable and important Neolithic site.
Yes, John Gator has been fascinated by the Ness for decades, but recently the geophysics surveys of the site that he's been doing threw up something which made the whole team gasp. The anomaly, as John described it, was so tantalising it just couldn't be ignored. So Time Team has headed north to try to get to the bottom of the mystery.
In fact, we're on site right now and Time Team members can follow every moment via Patreon. That's also where you can see our brand new film about the Ness of Brodgar, which ends with the amazing geophysics of, we've talked about it already, what looks like some sort of circle we don't quite know, but maybe it's a stone circle.
Yes, and Time Team's Jackie McKinley is all packed up and ready to join the action. Jackie, you must be really excited to go.
I am. I'm, apart from anything else, I'm looking forward to getting some cool, fresh air after all the heat we've had here, because I've been melting. I don't do very well in heat. But obviously, as you know, I go to Orkney in some way every summer, but this time it's going somewhere different, up to the Ness, which I've visited Nick Card on his site at the Ness numerous times, but I've never actually worked there. So yes, I am looking for... Now I've got the cat out of my suitcase. I'm sort of more or less ready to go.
Yes, don't take the cat.
Now, we need to talk about these geophysics images, don't we? And this thing that looks remarkably like a stone circle. I mean, what did you think when you saw it for the first time?
Well, I didn't think stone circle, but I did think, right. Oh, I think I know what that might be. Because at that point, I wasn't really very aware of the scale. It's a bit of a dark art to me as geophysics, to be honest with you. You know, you look at the pictures. But I must admit, my immediate thought was, double curbed cairn with a kist grave in the middle.
I was wondering what that thing was in the middle.
I mean, that's kind of what it looks like to me, is looking at that. I mean, it's quite big.
How big is it?
It's just under 8 metres diameter is the outer bit. But if you look, there's also a sort of slight inner one as well that's about sort of half that width. And then you've got this feature in the middle. So that was my immediate thought. I mean, it is quite large for a curbed cairn. But hey, you know, we're by the Ring of Brodgar. We've got the stones of Stenness to the south. We've got that fantastic ritual Neolithic feature there just to the south. So just because it's slightly bigger than I might expect, who knows? We're laying bets on it. John and I are laying bets on it. In beer, being John, obviously. Yes.
So does he think it's a stone circle then? What does he think it is?
He's sort of hedging on it possibly being a stone circle for now, but there might be a certain amount of, you know, wishful thinking going on both our parts, actually, because, as he said, it could actually be a garden feature because it's in somebody's back garden, although I think it's unlikely. Bearing in mind that garden, you can see the Ring of Brodgar just to the north of it. You can almost see the stones of Stenness if you duck around the house. So I think they've probably got enough stone circles. So I really have got my fingers crossed that this is going to be a curb cairn.
So is John's theory of the garden feature might be that if your neighbours have got one in the 18th century, you might think that life would all be a lot smarter and nicer if you had one as well. Because there are modern stone circles, aren't there? People do build them occasionally.
Yeah. It's a kind of folly, isn't it? I mean, that's all we're looking at here. It's a kind of folly that somebody's built, you know, somewhere to go and sit and have your picnics, and maybe they couldn't be bothered to build one quite as big as the Ring of Brodgar, which is quite large. So they've done a mini version of it. But it's the fact that you've got this feature in the middle as well, which is making me immediately, I went, ooh, kist grave. So a stone-lined grave, which you get a lot of in Orkney and Shetland, you know, the Northern Isles of Scotland and down that west coast.
Is a kist grave one of those tightly wrapped up ones, tightly flexed ones? Because it's quite small, this thing in the middle, and if the whole thing's 8 metres across?
Yeah. I mean, there's various things this could be, because kist graves are used you know, like I say, it's a stone box, essentially, with a lid on it. Now, it doesn't necessarily follow that it's even going to be an inhumation burial, because you do get kist graves in Orkney and down that west coast of Scotland where they have got cremated bone deposited in them. I think there's everything to play for, really. And I would, yeah, I mean, being somebody who is very interested in cremation, I would quite like it to be a cremation burial, but it could be a crouched inhumation burial as well, or you could have both, because that also can occur.
I really did think we were just, it's a stone circle, but now you've added all of this and now I'm not so sure. I just don't know. Anyway, we will only know when we dig it, and that is exactly what we're doing at the moment. Jackie, I thought as well it might be worth, because there will be a lot of people who know exactly, you know, where Orkney is, what Orkney is, and will know a lot about it. Probably people who are used to living in this country, but there might be people further afield who don't know the area very well, and you are a regular visitor to Orkney. So could you sort of put Orkney in a bit of context geographically?
Sure. Well, in order for me to get there, I have to drive up to Heathrow Airport. I get on a flight at Heathrow and I go to Edinburgh, and then I'll fly up directly north from Edinburgh, which goes up across the north of Scotland, goes over the Moray Firth, up one side of Caithness. We wave on the way past Wick, look down on the Pentland Firth, which is where we have, I don't like going on the ferry because I get a bit sick, but there are about 16 currents come in at the Pentland Firth, because you've got the North Sea on one side and the Atlantic on the other, and they're coming together. And then in front of you, you can see the Orkney Islands, and they are a whole series of islands. So we start off with South Ronaldsay at the bottom, work your way up across the Churchill barriers, because you've got Scapa Flow in the middle, to Burray, then across another Churchill barrier onto mainland Orkney. And that is where Kirkwall is. That's where I'll be landing. And then I'll be driving across to Stromness and going past Ness on the way past. So it's the Northern Isles. It's off the north of Scotland. You go from Orkney, then if you want to go further north to Shetland, which is north of it, you wave at Fair Isle on the way past, which is very fair, and then you get to Shetland. So the Northern Isles, beautiful.
You mentioned Shetland, and we should talk about Shetland as well, shouldn't we? Because we are going to Orkney, but this is part of a big Time Team Northern Isles odyssey, really, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. We are going to be at the Ness for the first week, and then we're flying off to Shetland, to the site we were last year, for a week. The southern half of Shetland is very like Orkney, so you've got quite a gentle, undulating landscape. And the northern half is more, I think it's more like the sort of northeast part of northeast northwest part of Scotland, where it's more moorland. And we're going to be down at this when we're working up in Shetland, we're going to be down at the south end. But like I said, what would be nice is we can wave at Fair Isle on the way past, which is that lovely little island in the middle between Orkney and Shetland.
Well, Jackie, you've painted a wonderful picture of Orkney and of Shetland as well. And I know that you're raring to go and get on that plane, or those planes, I should say, two of them, to go and join the team who are up there right now. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
As you said, you can follow the dig as it happens right now, as well as watch our new film about the Ness of Brodgar. We're there for a whole month and we're taking Time Team members with us. So go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial right now.
That's it for the Time Team podcast for today, though. Next week, I'm answering questions from Time Team members, and you can submit yours on Patreon.
Have a great rest of your week, and we'll speak to you soon on the next Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.